So what I thought I would do is, because he's not here to give us some background on health care in the West Bank and Gaza, is to look at the impact of the military occupation on the civilian population. I have no disclosures. And I'm basing my discussion on a health and human rights project I've been involved in since 2003. Our most recent delegation was in June. We go to Israel and the occupied territories. We've also helped establish an exchange program between Harvard Medical School and Al-Quds Medical students, so we have experience with them. We do support the Farah Center in Nablus, which is a center that Alam started for rehab medicine, primarily focused on children, and we also support speaking tours in the United States. We partner with Physicians for Human Rights Israel, and Rohama Martan is the founder of that group, and Palestinian Medical Relief Society, which was founded by Alam Jarrar. We also work with a lot of other organizations, NGOs, whether mental health, agriculture, prison rights. It's a very, very long list. So we actually have a broad experience in the region. Now, when we look at the issue of war and public health, I think we need to look at several things. What is the impact on civilians, the impact on medical personnel and the healthcare institutions, and the civil society around them? I think we need to think about our responsibilities to society as healthcare providers in its broadest sense, and the big challenge on this particular very hot topic is to always stay human. When we're talking about difficult topics, I urge us to, first of all, look at data, to take note of personal experiences and what are the facts on the ground, and to really work on humanizing the other, on being aware of our own prejudices, in order to understand the level of physical and psychological trauma. I think it's also useful to explore the personal narrative, which is the topic of my actual talk. And I would recommend anyone who's really interested in this to look at a series in The Lancet in 2009, which did an in-depth look at healthcare in the West Bank and Gaza. As we do this, I think it's very important to think of an overriding principle from the Geneva Conventions, and the principle is basically that the occupying power, in this case Israel, shall afford civilian medical personnel in the occupied territories the ability to practice medicine and care for their humanitarian functions. So if we look at healthcare in the West Bank, The Lancet describes it as fragmented and incoherent. We're talking about a population of 4.4 million people. Healthcare is delivered by the Ministry of Health, that's the Palestinian Authority. The United Nations Relief and Works Agency, or UNRWA, which takes care of refugees, which is about half the population. There are a huge number of NGOs, non-governmental institutions, such as Palestinian Medical Relief. People talk about the NGOization of the West Bank. Then there are private providers that are fee-for-service, basically, and then we have the role of the Israeli government. So just, you know, how did it get to be the way it is? Well, very briefly, in the 50s, the UN was responsible for the refugees, Egypt was responsible for the people in Gaza, and Jordan for the West Bank. After the 67 war, the healthcare system came under Israeli military control, and the focus was primarily public health and prevention, but there was no effort to establish an infrastructure or to build human resources. And you see this issue of de-development happening in this region a lot. So by 1980, the per capita spending in the occupied territories was $18 to $23 per person, as opposed to $500 for an Israeli. And there were no training programs or medical student schools allowed. Nonetheless, there were more hospital deliveries, and there was a decrease in perinatal and infant mortality. In 81, the healthcare system came under the establishment of the Israeli Civil Administration, again, a focus on public health, primary care. But if someone was really sick, they were referred to Israel for high-level care. And this is when we see the beginning of the growth of the NGOs. Medical Relief was founded in 1979. And health status improved, as well as nutrition, socioeconomics, vaccinations, all that kind of stuff. But still, it was very much less than in Israel. So infant mortality was 70 per thousand in the occupied territories and 14 per thousand in Israel, very discrepant. Then in 1993, with the Oslo Accords, the healthcare system came under the responsibility of the Palestinian Authority. I think it's important to remember that they tried to establish a healthcare system with all of their corruption issues and disorganization and all of that stuff that we know, but it was being done under Israeli military control. So imagine trying to establish a healthcare system with no control over water, over freedom of movement, over the import of medication, specialty training, all the things that are required to create a system. So what happened was a very complex disorganized system occurring in a setting of permits and authorizations and occupation. So this was really a fragmented failing system from the beginning. It got worse after the Second Intifada. It got worse after the beginning of the separation wall. What you need to know is that the main high-level hospitals are all in East Jerusalem, and the wall cuts off the hospitals from the majority of the East Jerusalemite population and the West Bank population. So there are lots of challenges, economic restrictions of access, attacks on medical services and personnel, destruction of infrastructure during the various incursions, and then violence, death, and disability, which is part of this region. So what happened? The per capita GDP decreased, more children became anemic, there's been a terrible brain drain from the occupied territories, hospital births decreased, you know, there was sort of a reversal of some of the gains that were made. And there's also this issue of access. So in 2006, 20% of patients treated in emergency rooms reported being delayed at checkpoints and having to make detours before they could get to the hospital. There was also a lot of documentation of direct assaults by the Israeli Defense Force on providers, limitations of movement, ambulances unable to reach the sick or wounded 30% of the time, wounded people saying they 70% of the time they had to actually get to the ambulance rather than the ambulance getting to them, and then ambulances being unable to get into East Jerusalem where the care was located. The consequences of this are obvious. You know, there was a study in 2002 showing a significant lack of drugs, lack of finances, inability of patients to get to doctors, doctors to get to patients. So public health, preventive care, and access to tertiary care has decreased. Then in 2006, we have the Gaza embargo, which was not only an embargo against weapons, but also medications, dialysis machines, and the kinds of things that keep a population healthy. Then there was the Israeli incursion in 2007 and the stricter siege of Gaza, which, quoting Danny Filk, who was the former head of Physicians for Human Rights, delivered a fatal blow to the Palestinian economy, resulting in severe poverty and in acute and chronic malnutrition. Things got worse in 2007 with factional violence. We talk a lot about loss of hope, increasing militancy. And by 2008, it was much more difficult for people in Gaza to get a permit, even if they had a severe life-threatening illness. The other thing that happened, and this has been documented by a number of Israeli human rights organizations, including Physicians for Human Rights Israel, is that the Israeli security forces use the giving of permits as a way to obtain collaborators. So this corrupts the whole ability of people to get high-level care in Israel. In 2010, the UN reported multiple obstacles, restrictions related to occupation. So this is restrictions in the movement of staff, patients, goods, construction, all of this contrary to international law. And they reported on this strict permitting regimen, the checkpoints, the closures, and also the arbitrary nature of these checkpoints and closures. So people never know, are you going to get through, are you not? Is it going to take 30 seconds? Is it going to take 3 hours? Are you going to go home the same day and never get through? So this became very obvious that there were increasing difficulties to provide aid to a very vulnerable population. And the ultimate consequence is life expectancy. So if you rank life expectancy in the occupied territories, this is a piece that came out in 2012, it's 97th for women, 86th for men in the world, and in Israel it's 12th and 9th. So clearly a major discrepancy. If we look more at Gaza, in 2008, the World Health Organization reviewed the lack of electricity and its obvious impact on the ability of healthcare institutions to function. The World Food Program revealed increasing risk of underweight infants, 82% of the population being food insecure. Then there were the incursions in 2008-2009 with a devastating impact on the infrastructure. And by 2012, the UN reported a fundamental infrastructure, quote, struggling to keep pace with a growing population. And this is just a visual of the kind of devastating impact on infrastructure. Hospitals were bombed, UN facilities were bombed. It was really quite devastating. B'Tselem, which is an Israeli human rights organization in 2010, talked about the prohibition about bringing raw materials into Gaza such that 95% of the factories and workshops in Gaza had to close at that point. So you can imagine the poverty. And things that were restricted included cement and iron, so people could not build their homes. So it was a huge problem of homelessness. So that the quantity of goods that came through the crossings was less than one quarter of what came through before the siege. And this led to a whole development of tunnels between Egypt and Gaza, which created a huge corruptive black market that also allowed Gazans not to starve. The other issue that Gazans are facing is problems with electricity. A huge number suffer from major blackouts every day, and the power outages obviously are related to lack of fuel and the ability to repair broken units, and they've also led to the improper operation of wells and desalination plants. And just to give you a visual, these tunnels are major deals. They drive cars through them. It's not just weapons, it's food, it's cows, it's medicine, it's all sorts of things that people need. B'Tselem also showed another major issue going on in Gaza, which is that 93% of the water is polluted with high quantities of chloride and nitrites. And not only is the water supply defective, but the waste treatment has also been affected because of the lack of electricity and supplies. So 100,000 cubic meters of untreated or partially treated wastewater flow into the sea at this point, which obviously affects the fishermen. And then there's the lack of pesticides and spare parts for irrigation, making it harder for the farmers. Again, in the UN, talked about how there's been an increasing restriction on access to farmland and fishing, both guaranteed by the Oslo Accords, again, devastating impact on the economy. This is primarily enforced by live fire since Operation Cast Lead, and there are additional risks related to armed factions and confrontations with the Israeli Defense Force. And one of the things that the IDF does is to level farmlands and property in what they consider restricted areas. So the reduced quantities of food, the shifts to low-cost, high-carb foods has had a big impact on diet. There are less kids going to school. It impacts on the economy of a family. Daughters are getting married earlier because the families can't afford to keep them. And the UN also reported major difficulties with construction because of the blockade and also tension with Hamas. And so Gaza conditions continue to deteriorate. This study in 2012 wrote the worst. It's been worse since the bombardments and the Operation Pillar of Defense in November. There are all sorts of other side things that happen, such as the increase in birth defects that's being reported associated with parental exposure to weapons-associated contaminants. There are obviously psychological consequences. Children do not feel secure. Their parents can't take care of them. When we were there, we're always hearing about the epidemic of bedwetting in Palestinian children. This is obviously a symptom of trauma. This was also documented by an interagency child protection working group, showing the increasing vulnerability for children, the increase in disabilities, and the negative psychosocial and mental health effects. So the last thing that I want to mention is the issue of humiliation in war and conflict and torture. Humiliation is both an individual and cultural experience for Palestinians. The occupier is also dehumanized by humiliating people. So this actually works in multiple ways. And Palestinians are not only humiliated by their loss of living conditions and employment, but they're humiliated every day at checkpoints, at prisons, and at nightly home invasions. And then the children witness the shaming and control of their parents by soldiers, which is having major impacts on family structure. And then there is increasing settler and state violence. So settler attacks have increased. The settlers do not get convicted. More and more Palestinians are being detained. 40% of Palestinian men have spent time in detention. There's an indefinite administrative detention that occurs where the detention just keeps getting renewed and renewed without ever having a trial or anything coming to an end. And a lot of children have been involved in this. Some 8,000 children have been detained, and there's no special court provisions for the treatment of children. And there's been a lot of documentation, again, Physicians for Human Rights Israel, about the ill treatment in Israeli jails. So what we need to remember is that healthcare is provided in the context of checkpoints, closures, curfew, bypass roads, the separation wall, Israeli incursions, detentions, and factual violence. How am I doing for time? I have 5 minutes. I have five more minutes. Yippee. Okay, I'm going to keep going. So I want to just give you a little bit of the personal because I think it makes it more real. This is a very quick story about Dr. Majed Week. We met him when he was the dean of students at Al-Quds Medical School, and his problem is that he has a West Bank identity card, but he works in East Jerusalem. And here we are meeting him in Ramallah, and he's showing us his four different ID cards, including an ID card for his car, and he has to have them all renewed at different times, and they all have to be up to date for him to get to work. And every day he goes to the same checkpoint, sees the same soldiers, shows them the same permits, waits, 2 minutes, 2 hours, 5 hours, doesn't get through, whatever happens, to get to work. And then he does the same thing coming home. This is Al-Quds University. Abu Diswal was built to separate the university from East Jerusalem, so it's had a major impact on the medical school, on education, on access to tertiary level care. This is Dr. Suha Tazami, who went to medical school there. She used to live right next to the medical school, and then the wall went up between her and the school. So it was a two-minute jog to school became an hour going around and waiting at checkpoints. She described trying to get to rotations on donkeys because she couldn't get to rotations in Nablus, and having her medical school education severely restricted. And then the other problem was that when she was in East Jerusalem hospitals, the wards were often empty because patients couldn't get to the hospital. When we were in Hebron at the Al-Akhli Hospital, Dr. Jabran described a fabulous new radiology suite they had, and they were very proud of their CT scan, but it hadn't worked for months because there was a critical part that was broken, and the Israelis were holding it at a checkpoint. So even the infrastructure of the healthcare system is under occupation. When we traveled to Ministry of Health hospitals, this is a pediatric unit in Jenin, the thing that's very striking is that you are immediately in the third world. They're totally overcrowded. This was a pediatric unit that's wall-to-wall cribs with the sick kid and then the 300 family members and everybody's eating, and it's like back in the third world. And this is, you know, several miles away from Hadassah Hospital. If we look at the separation wall very, very briefly, this is the West Bank. The separation wall is in red, and you can see that 85% of the separation wall is built within the West Bank, and that there are these big invaginations here and in here, so that the Jewish settlements are collected in these areas, and then the Israelis control the Jordan Valley. So what is being described is the Palestinians live in basically three cantons, this one, whoops, let me go back, whoa, wrong way. And the one in the south, and then that's all broken up by checkpoints. So what does that look like? Kalandia is a major checkpoint between Jerusalem and Ramallah, and as you can see, it's a major military installation. You can see the separation wall. And in the last few years, you see the, I'm sorry, I'm hitting this too much, these turnstiles, which are very narrow. Imagine that you're sick, you're a mother with five children, you're in a wheelchair. Imagine the kind of difficulties you have going through these tiny turnstiles, which are controlled by the soldiers, so people get trapped in the middle of the turnstiles. Palestinians talk about the humiliation of these turnstiles. There are checkpoints that you drive through, and everybody stops. We were in an ambulance in front of a UN vehicle, and we were waiting at a checkpoint. This is, again, turnstiles at another checkpoint, again, a point of humiliation and control. And if there's a big distance along the checkpoint, you see old people, you see sick people walking the distance. Medical Relief for a while had wheelchairs that people could just zoom back and forth because there were so many old people just struggling to get across them. Some of the checkpoints are big military installations like the one in Bethlehem, which is run by a private security company. So you can see the soldiers watching on top. They're looking at all the luggage, and men waiting and waiting and waiting for hours at this checkpoint. So this is when you get through to the other side, or if you're going through trying to get in out of Bethlehem, that sense of imprisonment, that sense of being under control is very powerful. And the UN in 2008 made the statement, which I think is still very true, that basically a policy that was once justified as a short-term military response to violent confrontations and attacks on Israeli civilians appears to be developing into a permanent system which was fragmenting the West Bank territory and affecting the freedom of movement of the entire Palestinian population. And this has led to, this is, one of the pregnancy handouts, like what to do when you're pregnant. This is what to do when you're pregnant and you're in labor and you're trapped at a checkpoint. This was put out by Medical Relief, but it's enough of a problem that they have to have an educational pamphlet. And when we went to visit the Farah Center, which Alam founded, when we talked to children who had major disabilities and developmental issues, they also had psychological issues. This young girl had had multiple home incursions in the middle of the night by Israeli soldiers, in addition to all of her other disabilities. When you visit refugee camps such as Dehesha, the UN clinics are just woefully understaffed. This clinic had one GP, one nurse, one midwife. They saw 200 patients a day, 6 days a week. You can imagine the quality of care. So in a clinician in a conflict situation, our role is to heal the patient. I think we should also be thinking about healing the society, bearing witness, seeing the human face, using our listening and diagnostic skills that we have been trained with to understand and increasingly understand the issues, and also to use the lens of healthcare and human rights to investigate and report on difficult areas of conflict. Thank you.